Today's program has been brought to you by Hearst Ranch, the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed, and grass-finished beef. For more information, visit HearstRanch.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to a live edition of The Main Course. Again, it's live, unless you're listening to it as a repeat. But I'm very, very happy that Hearst Ranch is sponsoring this episode because it is an unusual episode. We're going to talk about a culture that has to rely on curing a lot, but we're going to talk just about their cuisine in general. We have Frederick Berzelius, who is in from Aska, a Scandinavian restaurant with a Swedish nostalgia behind it. And then we're going to come to Sam Edwards, who's going to talk about the various spring, summer, fall, and winter aging rooms for his hams and how he's replicating nature. We're also going to talk about how pork has changed in taste, whether it be for the better or worse, over the past 80 years that his family has been in business. But first, I want to welcome Joe. Joe, are you still with the station? Are you there, Joe?
I'm here. How's it going?
Brother. So two exciting events, Joe. This Abruzzi-style Italian barbecue by none other than Chef Mark Ladner. Wow, everyone should RSVP to italianbarbecue.eventbrite.com, italianbbq at eventbrite.com, or .eventbrite.com. Yeah, Mark Ladner, he is really one of the very first supporters of Heritage. He came out to Kansas to visit some farms and is like, if you can take care of delivering Lupa what they need for 6 months, you can get all of the restaurant group. And true to his word, we delivered Lupa every single week for 6 months. And then we were delivered the accounts of all the Batali and Bastianich and Ladner restaurants. So very exciting that he would honor us with this kind of fun Italian barbecue with like really expensive coals. And it's going to be very unusual. So hopefully everyone will come to that. And then there's the May 19th, 2013 party. The Hawaiian Underground Party. Joe, do you know about that party?
Yes, I do. It's going to have Delaney Barbecue, I believe.
Heritage Foods USA?
Yes.
Untitled?
Maysville.
Court Street Grocers?
Roberta's Catering.
Gramercy Tavern? Tavern?
Gramercy Tavern, yeah. I think that's it. And then
Brooklyn Grange.
Yeah, that's it.
Empire Brewing. Music by DJ Reganomics. That is funny. Well, anyway, everyone should log on to our website, and that's called HawaiianUnderground.eventbrite.com. So, you know, for my one political message, Joe, fluff up the pillow because I'm going to talk for 2 minutes about my political message. I just saw the, by the way, we are a membership supported organization. Please sign up for a $60 or $120 membership and you get a free tote bag. That shows that you support information on the radio waves regarding food. Well, I just read this op-ed piece, and I know I showed it to you, Joe, the ag gag laws. And basically, it's turned it into a federal crime in certain states to take photographs of confined feeding operations, which is where people stuff most of the 10 billion livestock that we consume every year as a nation, and slaughterhouses. People are resisting putting in of cameras because they fear, you know, I don't know what they fear. It's a lot worse not to put them in. I mean, we literally have more cameras in outer space. I mean, you know, than we do in these, you know, key points of production where 10 billion livestock pass every single year. I mean, there is not a square inch of any city anywhere in the country that does not have a camera on it. But we can't get a camera there. Now, I understand, of course. They're like, well, we don't want someone from PETA watching this video. That's fine. We support what Temple Grandin says, you know, that it should be a third-party auditor that's who should, you know, be, you know, watching these things. But, you know, it's, of course, you know, they passed this law. All the states that have significant concentrated feeding operations immediately made it a crime. And, you know, I think we live in a country where we as Americans have the right to know that somebody's watching. And especially all of this relates to animal abuse. I mean, that's why you want to put the cameras in. You want people to act responsibly during the animal's last moments, but also during the regular moments of when, you know, it's being fed to grow, to feed us. So I find it absolutely shocking that these people, you know, don't want, you know, or prohibit any cameras whatsoever in any of these operations. So I'm hoping that these fast food chains start supporting it. And certainly my book, which is being published, I'm very happy to say, this spring by Little Brown, or next spring by Little Brown, you know, has a chapter on this. And, you know, it's really outrageous. So, Joe, are you still up?
Yeah, I did not off.
Okay, you did not off this time. Huh? Very, yeah. Very impressive. So we're going to take a very short break and hear a message from our sponsor, and also hear a cool original music that's been given to the station. And then we're going to come back with Frederick and talk about Scandinavian food traditions and his restaurant, Aska.
Without my walking stick, I'd go insane. Can't look my best, I feel like...
You're listening to Without My Walking Stick by Plexophonic on the HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
It may rain, and when it pours, can't go outdoors without my cane. If I ever left the house without my walking stick, that would just be something I could never explain. The thing that makes me click on Lover's Lane would be for naught if I were caught without my cane.
Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, pasture raised on 150,000 acres in Central California. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, free-range, sustainably produced, humane. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, the authentic flavor of the American West.
You know, HeritageRadioNetwork.org is a member-supported nonprofit organization. If you like what you're listening to, go to our website and click that donate button. Become a member and get special discounts, invites, VIP treatment, t-shirts, and more. Support us and our mission to bring you the freshest food content in the nation.
Well, we are back. Very exciting. We are with Frederick Berselius, who is the chef owner and founder of a very interesting 18-seat restaurant that's connected to a bar and that is also housed within Kinfolk Studio, a kind of artist's space. This is all on 90 White Avenue in Brooklyn. Very, very interesting. Welcome, Frederick.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
So just tell us very quickly, and then I'll get in a little bit to the you know, introduction of your restaurant and your mission, but describe this place. So it's a restaurant that's also part of a bar and also part of an artist community. Just give us the backdrop for our listeners who've never been.
Okay, so the restaurant is located inside Kinfolk Studios, which is a design studio on 90 White Avenue. A couple of founders of the space, they have a bar in Japan, they opened this place, they have a history in many of them street art, but graphic design, and they build bicycles. It's like a creative sort of environment.
How did you hook up with these guys, and what made them think to bring in a kind of progressive Scandinavian chef into an artist community in Brooklyn? It's funny. How did that happen?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think Brooklyn is the best place to... It's located in Williamsburg, and I mean, I think all of Brooklyn is... there's a lot of creativity going on. You're sort of allow yourself to try different ways and means of how to do things, open a restaurant, open a bar. This became a collaboration between us and them, where they had an idea about a bar and a design space, and I had an idea and a concept about food. No one was really doing what I wanted to do here.
Describe that concept. I mean, of course, we'll talk about it for the whole interview, but just so our listeners know what to be thinking for as you speak, what is that concept?
The concept of the food.
Yeah, and what you're doing there.
I mean, we have a... I'm from Sweden, and we do a... we cook... I call it Scandinavian food. It's
now, Scandinavia is a big region, right? Norway, Finland, Sweden, Denmark, Iceland.
Correct.
So even though you're Swedish, it still falls under the wider category of Scandinavia.
Yeah, I mean, we more look at the landscape, the similarities between the Northeast region in America and Scandinavia. And that means cold waters like in Norway, or, you know, warmer climates like southern Sweden. There are quite a wide varieties of zones in this region. So, and there's so many similarities that we wanted to connect with the whole region rather than just a country.
Sure. Well, I love looking at your website. Pictures of cold places, snow. I read the website. I mean, Aska, which means ashes, represents new and old, an ending and a beginning. Their philosophy is respect of nature, creativity, and hard work. Cooking is more to them than just a craft, and they're constantly focusing on ingredients, vegetables and meats, fish and offal, and weeds. I'll ask about weeds. see if we're talking about the same weed. We handpick the majority of produce served at the restaurant, they write. They used, of course, humanely raised animals, which I can vouch for because they do support Heritage Foods USA and our very small network of farmers. Of course, seafood. They cook equal parts forward thinking and nostalgia. So I kind of like that, equal parts forward thinking and nostalgia. Can you explain? And this will also inform my last question of what your concept is.
No, I mean, I think we base a lot of the flavors and the food at the restaurant is based on memories from, you know, from growing up in Sweden and Scandinavia. And I think a lot of times looking forward means to go back and see where you came from. We work with ingredients where we try and see them in every stage of their development. We want to know where our products come from. We want to get our fish and animals in whole as much as we can. And
but that's not unusual, right? I mean,
it's not unusual, but it's just trying to have an understanding of where your product comes from and why, and why it is the way it is at a certain time of year, for example.
Well, just so we can understand, what were some of the things? I mean, can you recall certain dishes or Swedish national dishes or traditions that you grew up eating and missing and recreating here at Aska?
So we don't want to recreate anything. We don't want to take an old staple dish and try and make it a new version that's cool. We want to look at the flavor profiles and what made them special to me, why they got stuck in my head. Many of my favorite memories of food are from childhood, many of them. And many of them are the extreme taste that are from, you know, cured meats or fish or fermented seafood, and also all the amazing, you know, berries and wild stuffs that we have over there.
You do have... Now, is there any plant... like fruit and vegetable agriculture in, Scandinavia? I mean, there must be very little, right? I always pictured it being fish, you know, meats, and wild berries. But right. Of course, there must be more, and yet still, those are big parts of the cuisine. So what grows in these snowy places?
I mean, there are tons of things growing all the time. There are many different kinds of berries growing all over the place. I think if you look at the size of the country and the amount of people living there, and you don't look to Stockholm, and you don't look to, if you look in the rest of the country, not the capital or three major cities, there's a lot of there's a lot of acres per person per capita, and there's a lot of forest and wildlife. I mean, I have memories just from my grandmother was from northern Sweden, and I grew up in Stockholm or the suburbs of Stockholm, and I just think that's another way of looking at just looking at the ingredient, because the best memories I have are from foods where one person or a small, you know, family focused on one ingredient. If it was herring, or it was, you know, dried reindeer meat, or or making berries, or just making food from scratch, even at home. You know, my mom cooks a lot; she always has. And seeing berries with the stems, with the leaves, having to clean them, having to make them. You know, that's how we try and cook at the restaurant too. We want the product in the way it is, in its natural state, so we know exactly how, in what state it is, what shape it is, what ripeness it is, and then work our way understanding it before it becomes a dish or on a plate.
Is there something that you do that you are maybe you have not seen done in New York or Brooklyn or anything like that? Is there a specific, I mean, can you get reindeer meat here? I've never seen that.
No, there are a lot of deer here, but not reindeer.
Is it the same species? Well, you have mainly reindeer that run wild, like our deer do here?
They don't run wild. I mean, they run wild in nature. Like, they run wild in nature, mm-hmm. but they're owned by someone.
I see.
There's wild deer, but reindeer is a different species, or different species. Reindeer, you know, traditionally you would have nomadic people, or the Samis, traveling around with the deer. But in the middle of winter, you can go skiing in Sweden, and all of a sudden a herd of, you know, 30 animals come running across the mountain, and this is true, you know. It is, but that's amazing, having these memories of a guy standing just selling his meat. Those are foods that I miss being here. Mm-hmm. Do we do reindeer meat? No, we don't. But like, goat, for example, sometimes we get, you know, we have cured goat or dried goat that we serve sometimes, and that's goat heart, and that to me could represent this memory of food. And it just has to have many chefs in New York cook, you know, obviously amazing foods, but to me the food that we serve has to have to represent something. Every dish represents something. It might not be explained at the table exactly what it means, but it has a history. It has a...
Yeah, it has a terroir to it, a whole culture and everything. So you really do cook from memory. So this is very personal. It's something that you might have tasted, and now you try to not copy it, because nothing is ever authentic, because it's different ingredients and it's a different place in the world and all that, but you're essentially trying to give these taste epiphanies, these magical moments to the guests based off of your, I mean, I hate to say this, for me, one of those taste memories I was thinking is like Sunkist soda, because I grew up in 1970s and early 80s, and I remember when all of a sudden it wasn't just Coke. Then all of a sudden Sprite came and Sunkist. And man, when I tasted that Sunkist, I was like, and I've never been able to duplicate that taste again, because I think they use worse ingredients to make it today. And plus, of course, I've already tasted it. So
right.
It's no, not quite the same.
But that's true, though. That's you find something, you find this eel and you cure it and smoke it. And all of a sudden it tastes just like, I remember that day that, you know, when we were, like, the whole family was down by the, in southern Sweden, in the archipelago, and that's kind of like, I wish, that's what I would want to happen with the food on the, in the bigger picture. But
now, are kids brought into food more there in that countries, in those countries, than here? Like, did you hunt? Did you fish? I mean, was what was your school lunches like? You know, what? How is food treated there? I mean, here it's very much taken for granted in the United States. This is the thing of home of fast food and all this. I mean, how can you characterize a little bit in Sweden and Scandinavia?
I mean, I was brought up with more home cooking than eating anything like any fast food or eating anything else. Both my mom cooked a lot. My dad would spend little time on the barbecue once in a while, but my mom very much liked cooking from scratch. And in the fall, you get apples, and you would use those apples, and you would make apple. You know, the pantry would have applesauce in it for the next few months. And in the berry season, you would have berries being turned into jam. And
we didn't. What are the names of these berries? Are they names that exist here? And I mean, blueberry, blackberry, things like that.
Yeah, blueberries, blackberries, raspberries, cloudberries.
But the wild kind, the intense. Kind.
Yeah, and the thing is, that can be a problem here because the flavors are stronger. You know, they develop different characteristics over there because of the climate they grow in. We have a somewhat colder climate, longer days, but a little bit colder than here.
The harsher the conditions, the sweeter the juice almost.
I think, I mean, the sun has one part in making them sweeter or more intensified. And then, you can stress plants. All they want to do is reproduce and survive. And then, the cloudberries can I think they can persist like minus, negative degrees, freezing temperatures. And some of these conditions just make them taste better.
So let me ask about the berries. That's very interesting to have such a berry-based culture. But let me ask about the restaurant scene there. Like, for instance, in Italy, most people eat at home. And then the next step up is the osteria. And then you have the trattoria, which is a little fancier. And then, of course, there's some fine dining restaurants in the big cities and such. Here in America, we have the coffee shop and the diner. In England, they have the pub. Where do people go in the, like Sweden, for instance? Is there a certain category of restaurant? And what are the traditional dishes?
I think it's changing. I mean, I've lived in New York for the last 12-something years. So I'm not really sure what's going on over there. But I know many people still cook at home. It is the caring for food is still strong. You know, people care about what they eat, and people spend a lot of time cooking, generally speaking. I think, you mentioned to me before school lunches. I think school lunches and even cooking in school, the classes you were given when you were like 10, 13 years old, back then they didn't mean much to me, or they didn't... I like cooking class in school, but I didn't like the school lunches very much back then. I would often go home and make my own lunch. But looking back, they were actually quite substantial. I think they did a pretty good job. Again,
what did you have? Chicken a la King, Sloppy Joes, like we did here?
We would have pancakes on Thursdays and blood pudding once a week, and we did also have fish sticks and chicken once in a while. But I think how do you cook for 400 kids and get the
and
food
and still make it good
and get the food out in 20 minutes? It's not easy, and that's one of the reasons I appreciate it more now. But again, if you can find... When it got confusing when they started doing weird experiments, you know, when these school cafeteria lunch ladies got more free hands and they started incorporating all kinds of weird spices everywhere. And that was a tricky period. But I think, you know, basing cooking in general on a good quality ingredient is the main focus, you know. And that has to do with cooking, and nostalgia and forward thinking goes back to that. The main idea is to find an ingredient and hopefully good enough to let it speak for itself. Mm-hmm. You know, we at the restaurant we use rather simple ingredients in many ways, and how to get them to be special is the main.
Now, fish, for instance, people FedEx fish all around the world. I mean, it almost has to be FedEx from the port to the. So, are you looking for?
I mean,
Northern European fish.
No.
Breeds, or are you saying what's yes and no. here in the rivers here, and then I want to make that taste like it was there?
Yes and no. If something is, you know, wintertime we get herring here. I mean, we know that the restaurant is not located in the middle of the woods or by the ocean or by the. I mean, come on. Yeah. We know we're in Brooklyn. It's in New York. Mm-hmm. I love where we are, and I love this place. So. The reaching out for fish, we have to work with trying to find the right purveyors giving us that, and then it happens that we do get fish FedExed in from Cape Cod or Maine, and there are many species here that are the same or similar to what we have in Scandinavia.
Because that's the north, right?
Yeah,
basically
the cold waters. Sweetwater fish is harder to get here, you know. Scandinavia has saltwater sweet and, you know.
What, in lakes?
Lake fish. That's what I would want more of here.
Sweetwater fish.
Yeah.
Hmm.
But, you know, we use pike, walleye pike sometimes, which doesn't exist in Sweden, but it's a sort of cross in between two fish that I grew up eating or fishing. So, yes, we used to fish herring at home. We used to, you know, go crab hunting or fish pike or perch, fish like that.
Very, very interesting. So what is the toughest thing you do? I mean, dish. I mean, do you, where is most of your energy more than any other issue, you know, dedicated? Is it to curing meats, curing fish, towards breaking down ingredients and doing something to them and yet still trying to make them simple? Like when you think about your week next week, what's going to be the greatest challenge or just toughest obstacle for the menu?
There are many things going on a regular basis, just running a restaurant.
Things so, curing and running the people and all that?
We have, this spring was the longest, coldest spring I can remember in the last couple of, it's taken forever, nothing, I mean, today is a beautiful sunny day and you're sitting here in shorts, but
I'm the only one though.
I think, when I love fall and winter, you know, I love seeing root vegetables and cabbages and what's at the farmer's market. And Then you have it for a month and two, and you keep going through those different varieties, and then you end up, you know, winter never ended. So now, this is my favorite time of year when everything, again, every season is my favorite season. But the biggest obstacle is finding the right ingredient. You know, we want to, nothing, the farmers market is getting sparse and sparse. Nothing is growing out in the wild. The ground is frozen. It's snowing, you know, randomly. Mm-hmm. That can be an obstacle. Or it's windy and snow when the fish doesn't show up. You know, we were expecting scallops and it was raining and they didn't show up. That can be an obstacle. But the food that we make is very hands-on. You know, everyone in the kitchen is very sort of engaged and involved in the product, in the restaurant, in
but
the work.
But a la minute or in preparation before the diner comes?
More in just working with what's around us. Like, taking an ingredient, talking about what we can do with it, how we can
make it the most interesting. Yeah.
And so if we get the fish in whole, like we always do, we might not use all the parts of it now. So that's when curing might come in.
I see.
And we might salt and dry a whole side of fish and use it 3 months from now. Or we might, you know, ferment fish and use it next year.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Any shark? Or no, you're not allowed. That's more, yeah. Iceland, right?
Yeah, I think that's Iceland. Northern Norway.
Does that taste terrible?
I was just in Iceland a month ago for a couple of days, and I didn't get to taste it, which was crazy.
Now, when you show up to Iceland, do people look at you and listen to the way you talk and say, hey, that guy's from Sweden? Or can someone from Norway, be confused with someone from Denmark? Because, I mean, you go Italy, two regions, yeah, from Rome to Sicily, and you're in the same country, and yet you're like, that guy's Sicilian, that guy's Sardinian.
No, there are many, many, many different accents, even in the narrow country of Sweden. So you can always most likely tell where a person is from, you know, if they're from middle, north, south, sort of semi-north.
I don't mean to stereotype here, but even physically, I mean, do they all look different?
Because
a Spanish guy and a English guy, I don't know, might look a little bit different, but...
Sometimes you can, yeah, I think so.
It's an interesting question. This was not part of the thing.
I think you can tell a lot of times
just by looking.
By looking, if you're from Denmark or Norway or Sweden or Finland.
Yeah, I know so little about it. I've been to Europe, you know, probably 20 times, and yet I've never been to these northern countries. Yeah. I'm dying to go.
You should go. But I also think, I think the Icelandic language is very, very interesting and very beautiful, because it has some, it's, you know, an ancient sound to it. Mm-hmm. I think it's probably the closest to a Norse language.
Well, this has been very, very interesting. I mean, there were 10,000 questions that I could have asked. I think it's very interesting. I mean, we didn't even talk about what is, you know, some people consider to be the number one restaurant in the world, which is Noma and Fäviken. Yeah. So, I mean, those guys are doing very interesting stuff. Although I heard there was like a food poisoning or something at one of these places. Very bad.
I mean, that's...
I felt bad. Someone just told me at the bar.
Yeah, no, I mean, unfortunately, food poisoning is the worst thing that can...
happen to a restaurant.
Or a person. I mean, I remember getting food poisoned in Paris once, and that was...
terrible.
Just, yeah, it's insane. And, I mean, these... I think it gets more put in the spotlight when you have a number one restaurant in the world, and but again, then you have 40-80 staff and people are working there, you know, people working insane hours, and there's, you know, people probably come into work when they're sick, and people come in, and then there's cross-contamination, and that's why it's important to if you have a restaurant, it's always very, 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 very important to take care of your
food. And wash your hands, everybody. Let that be a lesson to you. Wash your hands. But thank you so much. So your website is aska.com.
It's askanyc.com.
Oh, askanyc, askanyc.com. And it's a very, very, very fun place to go, because you're not just going to a restaurant. There's a bar, there's food, there's this artist community. You're in a really cool part of Brooklyn. So I really recommend to all our listeners who... I would say all have one thing in common, that I had very few experiences with Swedish and Scandinavian food. So this is a chance to get a little bit of Noma in New York without sans food poisoning. Thank you so much, Frederick, for coming on.
Thank you very, very much for having me.
And we will come right back after a very short break to wrap it up with Sam Edwards talking about imitating nature.
And how I'm pow.
This one's called I'm Paw by Plexophonic on the HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
I'm Paw with shooting dice, 'cause it's a vice I'll late each night, and that's not right. So I'm Pow with Wahines too. Believe me, it's true. I'm Pow. I do that down, that da do day, that da do day. I do ba bound, I do do bed day. I do that da ba do ba bound. I do la dum din do do la dum. I do la dum din do do la dum. I do ba do da do day da da bound. Do ba do ba bound. De do ba bound. Ba 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 do. I do la dum. I do la dum. Do the get that. Da 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 do pain, da 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 do pain. A do ba do da da day, da da bound to bound. I'm Pow with Okole How. You betcha and how. I'm Pow.
We are back with Mr. Sam Edwards III from Surrey, Virginia. Welcome, Sam.
Hello, Mr. Martins.
Hello, Mr. Edwards. So we just had a very interesting conversation with Frederick. When you are in town for the Fancy Food Show, we should definitely zip on by and try some of this stuff. But we were talking about Scandinavian cuisine. And
I was listening in. It was interesting.
Yeah, very interesting. Right now, of course, you live in a place that's nice most of the year. And yet you're still in the art of curing, you know, which is a tradition that most people develop when, you know, they're trying to survive the winter. So I was hoping that you could break down for us, since the theme is similar, your summer, your spring, summer, you know, and fall and winter rooms. And you kind of are replicating nature, right? You're trying to trick the hams into thinking that they are going through the seasons.
What we're trying to do is work with nature.
Okay.
In other words, if Mother Nature is providing us the summer months, but we need to be producing winter month temperatures and humidities, we have rooms that can kind of control that so we can make the product year-round. But what we've also been able to do, and again, this is just something that it's not an exact science. It takes a lot of attention to detail and tapping in on what you've learned over decades of doing it, is to take the best of Mother Nature and try to duplicate that by having rooms that mimic winter, spring, summer, and fall, and with the right airflow, the right temperatures, and the right humidities to produce a consistent product or quality of product that you're trying to target.
Well, can you break that down? I mean, how?
Yeah,
tell me the spring room.
In the good
instance.
Old days before there was electricity, what we would do is butcher the hams in the winter, or butcher the hogs, rather, in the winter, and put them in salt. So, allowing Mother Nature's spring and summer temperatures to be part of the curing process. So, today we have rooms that we maintain at 40 degrees to duplicate a typical Virginia winter. We put the hams in salt, fresh hams, and we get those from a wide range of variety of pigs, but we like the Berkshire and the pasture-raised certified humane heritage pork, and we leave them in there, depending on the size, anywhere between 25 and 32 days.
Now, let me ask you, Sam, what if you lived in Alaska? Would you still try to replicate those same temperatures, the Virginia winter?
I don't think you could replicate them today because you can control the room temperatures. In Alaska, in the dead of winter, you'd be providing heat because salt will not absorb into the meat at, you know, below 33, 34 degrees very, very well. If you look at the latitudes on Earth, as a band all the way around the world, the best countries that have a history of curing meats well are between those latitudes. That would be Spain, Germany, Italy,
Scandinavia,
of course, Virginia. and you know, it kind of lends itself to doing it correctly through Mother Nature's changes in temperature. Again, way back when, it was all about survival. How do we butcher an animal and have it to cure it to have the meat to eat later on? Mm-hmm. Because you couldn't obviously eat that much pork in one sitting, and they kind of figured out somehow. I've been told, attributed to the Chinese 3,000 years ago, that or maybe 5,000 years ago. What's plus or minus 2,000, right?
Same thing.
You know, they figured it out somehow. And, of course, it's that type of, that method of curing is common around the globe.
Well, take us through the
temperature ranges.
That you were talking about airflow and how that changes from season to season. So is the spring room windier? I mean, do you have fans in there? I mean, I know you blow smoke on your hams at one point, but...
Yeah, I mean, we go into springtime, and we do have ceiling fans in there, and we provide airflow that produces the conditions on the surface of the ham that we think is best to cure the ham. You still want the ham during the springtime to be dehydrating, but you can't get it too dry on the surface because they will encase. The outside of the meat becomes hard, and the moisture in the ham gets trapped. If you trap too much moisture in the ham, it'll spoil. So it's a kind of a, well, let's go and take a look at them today and see what we need to do. Speed the fans up, slow the fans down, cut them off altogether. And when Mother Nature is providing the right humidity, we'll open the windows up and give it a good dose of fresh air during certain steps of the process.
Where does it go? Where does the mass go when it dehydrates? This might be a stupid question, but I mean, if everything's being kept within the ham, how is it shrinking? I mean, is it sweating? Well, is it evaporating?
Yeah, when you look at the ham in the dry curing in the salt, you'll literally see moisture coming out of the hams, running out on the floor. When you go into the springtime room, the same thing. The floors look damp, and they're constantly dripping. We go from the springtime room into our smokehouses, which we're going wintertime is 40, spring is 50, and we gradually raise the temperature up to 85 degrees and begin the smoking process, which we go more by color than by time. So anyway, we get to that color we're looking for, that dark mahogany color at 85 degrees. And the balance of the time, we keep them in what we call aging rooms. And the hams will hang there, depending on the flavor profile you're looking for, anywhere from 3 months to, we actually are producing some that's 4 years old now.
And I bought one.
Yeah, you did.
I had to, it was like pulling teeth, but I finally got to buy one. Jeez.
Has it been shipped yet?
No, I don't know, but I keep the printout of what Keith, your head of sales, sent me. It was very exciting about the sea salt and 4 years, so I keep it on my desk, and we're going to cut it up at the meat shop and split it amongst the staff, so everyone's very excited about a four-year-old ham.
It really does taste uniquely different.
Is it more like the Spanish?
I think it has its own unique flavor profile. There is some similarities to the. It's when you eat a well-aged, say Iberico Bellota ham, and you literally chew on it and then swallow it. There's like this peanut buttery thing that happens to the side of your tongue. That's really unique and adds a different flavor profile to it that I think a lot of folks that eat that type of product really like.
Hmm.
Well, so anyway, we go to the aging room, and again, the hams are still shrinking. They're still, we call them going through the summer sweat in the aging rooms. The hams that we age for 18 months to 2 years, we're literally in the aging rooms, raise and lower the temperatures to duplicate the summer and fall and winter, through each year's process, and bringing in fresh air too. But you got to be really careful because you want to try to control the mold as much as possible. Not that it's harmful, but in Virginia, the humidity in the summer can get up to like 90%, and mold will grow overnight. So we try to keep the humidity around 65-70%.
And then?
And then once it's ready, again, depending on the type of ham, some of them are 3 months old, which are, you know, kind of a milder flavored dry cured ham, or the traditional European style ham that we slice it paper thin, and when it's reached the right amount of age, it's, we actually take a probe and stick into the hock of the ham and the center of the ham, it's each one, just to make sure that it's developed the right amount of flavor. Now, and you can tell that by the aroma.
Are you always trying to get it to taste less salty, or are country hams always supposed to taste very salty? I mean, I know your European-style thinly sliced ones taste just like the European ones, so kind of low on salt taste.
But you know, if you take this ham that we're producing that's 18 months to 4 years old and slice it as thinly as you do a prosciutto,
it tastes just like a prosciutto.
The saltiness is... No, it doesn't taste just like it. There's difference.
Right.
But the saltiness is very, very similar. And I contend there's something going on. I don't know what the science is behind it, but as that fat in the ham begins to meld with the lean meat over that course of time, the saltiness becomes less noticeable.
Mm.
It really does impart a really unique flavor that's similar, yes, to the Serrano and the prosciutto, but it's got its own little
thing
American
going on
bent to it.
So my last question, Sam, and of course, you know, you're a constant guest on the network, so, you know, this isn't going to be the last question I ask you, but for today, has pork gotten better or worse since your family started, when is it, 1926? Is that right?
Yeah, commercially. I mean,
commercially,
they were doing
right.
It before. Yeah, before then they were.
So is pork better or worse?
Farm. Yeah, I mean, it's changed a lot. I think right now people are paying attention more to the quality of the pork.
Mm-hmm.
When I say quality, I mean, everybody sets their own level of quality. There for a while it was all about how lean can we get it.
Mm-hmm.
And in some cases they did too good a job of getting it lean, which made pork pretty bland.
Mm-hmm.
So the good news about breeding pigs is they, over a short period of time, you can breed enough fat back into it. But I think stress has an impact on the flavor profile. I think that's why the heritage pork that we get from the Midwest and some locally, the breeds that we use, the Berkshire, the Gloucester Old Spot, the Tamworths, has enough fat marbling in them for the type of product that we make, dry cured beef.
But what,
you know,
about the product?
Product is pumped, it's not as critical that you have all that fat in it.
Hmm.
Because they're adding moisture to the ham through water. Which, you know, if it's a super lean piece of meat, it helps make it palatable because they're injecting the flavor into the meat itself.
But the average American, the average pork chop on the average American table, better or worse?
Worse.
It's
worse than it was in the 60s, a pork chop. And then it got really bad up until, in my opinion, like the late 90s.
Huh.
And it's starting to reverse itself some, but still not enough people recognize. It's a healthy, and again, I think stress has a tremendous amount of impact on the finished product.
Hmm.
You know, the hog is releasing certain enzymes at the time of death under stress that impacts the flavor of pork. Negatively, the breed, the I don't want to use anybody's particular brand, but the super lean breeds are, you know, the flavor's been bred out of them.
Don't worry, I'll mention all the brands in my book. Well, listen, Sam, it is always a pleasure. I enjoy my conversations with you every week, and I know our listeners do on our show. So thank you so much for being on today on a Sunday. Send my love to Donna, please, and the kids.
My pleasure. Please eat a piece of Roberta's pizza for me. I can't wait to get back to New York and do that.
Don't worry. Patrick Fartins is on the case. And I want to thank Frederick Berzelius very much for being on. I encourage everyone to expand their horizons and go check out his place. I want to thank Joe Galarraga for engineering and Hearst Ranch for sponsoring. Stay tuned for the next show on the docket, Straight No Chaser, hosted by Katie Kiefer. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.